Hi everybody and welcome to this episode of the Heart Podcast. It's James Rudd here, the digital media editor at Heart. Today I'm delighted to be talking to Mr. Norman Briffer, who is a cardiac surgeon from Sheffield in the UK. And we talk all about his review paper, which covers antithrombotic therapy after valve intervention. We have a great discussion about the different types of heart valve interventions, both percutaneous and surgical, the evidence and the evidence gaps, and I hope you enjoy the show. Please do leave us a review. If we're able to, it really does help us to reach new listeners. Thank you so much for joining me today for this episode of the Heart Podcast. Maybe we can start off by having you introduce yourself for the podcast audience. Who are you? Where do you work? And what do you do there?
Good morning, James. First of all, thank you for the invitation and for including this paper in your podcast. My name's Norman Briffer. I'm a consultant cardiac surgeon, and I work at Northern General Hospital in Sheffield, which is part of the Sheffield Teaching Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust. I'm also a reader at the University of Sheffield, and until fairly recently, I was associate editor at the Heart Journal. I've also been treasurer and president of the British Heart Valve Society. Incidentally, as we're talking about all things heart valve, Northern General Hospital, lots of people don't know this, but the Northern General Hospital in Sheffield is where the world's first ever heart valve replacement took place back in 1955.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Sadly, the surgeon who did it never wrote it up, but somebody else wrote it up as a very small article in the 90s.
And was that a mitral valve or aortic valve?
It was a mitral valve without bypass. The patient survived about 6 hours.
Wow, a world first.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. My own interest, apart from my interest in general heart valve disease, in terms of surgery, my interest is in mitral valve surgery. And I'm one of four at the Northern General Hospital. We take referrals from all over Yorkshire and beyond.
Fantastic. And you've recently written a lovely review paper, which is called Antithrombotic Therapy After Heart Valve Intervention, a review of mechanisms, evidence, and current guidelines. And that's with some colleagues from Leeds and from Sheffield. And maybe we can start off by talking about the rationale for writing this review. What was the sort of the reason for going into it at this stage?
So the easy part of the answer to your question is that this was commissioned by Catherine Otto, who was editor-in-chief, and she asked her associate editors to write a review for publication. And the reason I picked this subject is that the number of patients undergoing a heart valve intervention is probably the highest it's ever been. In terms of surgery, the percentage, as a percentage of total cardiac surgical practice, the number of valve repairs and replacements, again, is the highest it's ever been. When I started practice, it was 30% or less. It's now more than 60%. In my case, it's 70 to 80%, but most of the work I do is mitral valve. And this, together with the explosion in the number of transcatheter procedures, as well as the often confusing array of anticoagulants and antiplatelet agents that are available to us today, I thought makes this an important topic to write about.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. It can be confusing even for people that work in the field. And you say it's an important and growing issue. There's never been more valve interventions, both surgically and transcatheter mechanisms. But let's talk about thrombus itself. What are the mechanisms that lead to thrombus formation on valve prostheses? And why are some locations in the heart more dangerous than others?
So as the listeners know, thrombus formation is initiated via the intrinsic, extrinsic pathways of the coagulation cascade, something we learned from when we were at medical school. So blood is exposed to either tissue factor, which is released when tissue is damaged. Its release, thrombus is initiated when blood is exposed to subendothelial collagen, when it's exposed to foreign surfaces, or activating factors, which are released by activated or damaged platelets. And all of these pathways are involved in the thromboembolic risk associated with heart valve devices. And all heart valve devices have some degree of thromboembolic risk. Shear stress and blood velocity also comes into play, and these two factors explain why the thromboembolic risk is greater in the AV valve, i.e. mitral rather than aortic on the left and tricuspid rather than pulmonary on the right. But also, if you compare the thromboembolic risk of the mitral and the tricuspid is worse, and that's related to blood velocities and shear stress. The other important point to make is that the risk in tissue valves, for example, bioprosthetic valves, which is mainly clot formation on the fabric or the sewing ring, which is a foreign surface, or on the leaflets, which are made from usually bovine pericardium, it's transitory. So the risk decreases with time because of re-endothelialization. Whereas in mechanical valve prosthesis, the main risk is associated with flow, abnormal flows and eddy currents that occur near the hinges of the mechanical leaflets. And this risk is persistent, hence the need for lifetime anticoagulation. And the final important point to make about this is also is that systemic risks of thromboembolism, such as age, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, antiphospholipid syndrome, all increase the risk of thromboembolism in patients who have heart valve devices.
And let's talk about mechanical surgical valves first of all. I must say that the schema showing the coagulation pathways and sites of drug action is nicely shown in figure one. But if we turn first of all to mechanical valves, what are the sort of generally accepted recommendations there, both in the European Union, UK and USA? They're all fairly much in alignment, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of guidelines. You have guidelines from different societies, guidelines from the different parts of the world, different specialties. So you've got, you know, cardiology guidelines, you've got hematology guidelines, and it can get a bit confusing. And nowadays, obviously, we also have trust within the NHS, we have trust-based guidelines for anticoagulation. I think the easiest way to remember this is to use the INR range of 2 to 3 as your starting point. A range is always more desirable than a fixed point, because as I intimated earlier, no two patients are exactly the same. But if you start with as your starting point, an INR of 2 to 3, and then if the patient has a feature that's going to increase the risk, the commonest being a mechanical valve in the mitral position rather than the aortic position, an old style mechanical valve such as a ball and cage as compared to a bileaflet valve, which is what is invariably used today. If a patient has atrial fibrillation, if the patient has poor left ventricular function, and some others that I list in the paper. So if a patient has one or more of these risk factors, then you need to increase your INR range by 0.5 to 1. So it's rather 2 to 3, you should bring it up to 2.5 to 3.5 or 3 to 4.
And we should just recapitulate that for mechanical valves, it's lifelong warfarin, isn't it? With those different
INR absolutely. It's got to be warfarin and no other.
Yeah. Is there any reason that NOACs like dabigatran have failed to show benefit over warfarin for mechanical valves? Are there any theoretical reasons that might be the case? Because clearly it would be much more convenient for patients and healthcare providers if we could use NOACs.
No, absolutely. It is one of the problems that interferes with acceptance of mechanical valves. But there have been two trials. So warfarin has been compared to both dabigatran and apixaban in patients with mechanical valves. We have far more data on the dabigatran trial, which was called Realign. The apixaban trial was interrupted and suspended, and we still don't have the full data from that trial. But anyway, in the Realign study, the dabigatran study, dabigatran failed really badly because patients in the intervention group ended up having both increased thromboembolic events and increased bleeding events compared to patients in the warfarin. There are probably both pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic reasons for the failure of NOACs in this field. Dabigatran worked really well in vitro, in an in vitro circuit which used either porcine and human blood, and was far more effective than warfarin in preventing thrombus formation on a bileaflet prosthesis that was placed in the circuit. Now, you can test clotting risk in an ex vivo circuit, but you obviously can't test bleeding. And an important point was the drug concentrations in the perfusate in this in vivo circuit were much higher than those achieved in patients during the clinical trial. The other thing is anticoagulants, where they work in the cascade is probably also important. That's the PK side of it. So as we know, NOACs tend to work later in the cascade by inhibiting factor 10 and thrombin.
Yeah.
And as the clotting cascade is now amplification cascade. So inhibition at an early stage requires much lower levels of drug than similar inhibition higher up in the cascade. And we know that Wolfram works at multiple levels in this cascade by inhibiting vitamin K-dependent factors. And that, again, is important from both a PK and a PD point of view.
And let's move on to bioprosthetic heart valves. Now talking with your surgical hat on, for those who are maybe not aware, not so experienced as you, when do you typically use a bioprosthetic heart valve versus a mechanical heart valve? Just out with any conversation about thrombosis.
Yeah. So this is a huge hobby horse of mine. I'm a great fan of mechanical valves in the aortic position. To me, the strongest evidence by country mile which guides which prosthesis to pick comes from two randomized trials, which are quite old now. They started in the late 1980s and published in the early noughties. One was based in the United States, and the chief investigator was legendary Shabuddin Rahim Tula, who, you know, of hibernating myocardium fame and patient prosthesis mismatch fame. And the other big trial was based in Edinburgh. But these were huge trials, over 500 patients in each trial. So by the time of their publication, we had 15 to 20-year outcomes. And because of all sorts of reasons, a trial like this will never be replicated. These were the trials that defined the Achilles heels of the two types of prosthesis, namely bleeding in those patients who had mechanical valve prosthesis who were on warfarin, and degeneration of tissue prosthesis requiring further surgery, especially in patients who are under 65 when they underwent surgery. So we know this about the two facts, and these facts were established by these two trials. The important point that came from the US trial is that after 15 years, there was not even one single case, certainly in the aortic patients, there was not one single case of either valve thrombosis or structural failure, which shows mechanical valve in the aortic position is extremely safe. And patients under 65 with mechanical valves lived longer than those who had a tissue valve implanted, despite the increased bleeding risk. And this finding of improved prognosis with mechanical valves has been replicated several times in various observational studies over the years. Now, obviously, since then, a lot has changed. All the mechanical valves used in those trials were old-fashioned single leaflet devices. The ones we use today, as you know, are bi-leaflet valves. And the INR targets then were a bit higher than the targets we use today. And unfortunately, to my mind, for all sorts of non-evidential reasons, guidelines and practice has changed a lot. And valve and drug companies are just not investing in new designs of mechanical valve or new designs of anticoagulants. Having said that, I'm still very proud of the fact that in Sheffield remain one of the highest users in the UK of mechanical prosthesis in younger patients.
Brilliant, because I guess that avoids the need, hopefully, for reoperation, which is what you are suggesting happens with
bypass. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, valve and valve TAVI, notwithstanding, I don't think the facts have changed, really. I think if you have a mechanical valve when you're young, you are likely to survive longer than if you have a tissue valve.
And let's talk about the requirements for anticoagulation for bioprosthetic valves. This is nicely summarized in both figure 2 for European guidelines and figure 3 for US guidelines. And you mentioned at the beginning the highest risk of thrombosis with a bioprosthetic valve is just after implantation, for a few months after implantation. And for an uncomplicated patient, how would you proceed after implantation of a bioprosthetic valve?
So when it comes to tissue prosthesis, in those big trials, patients were not anticoagulated. So patients who had a tissue prosthesis, and most of the patients in those two didn't have pericardial tissue prosthesis. They had porcine tissue prosthesis. But there is an elevated risk, as you mentioned, and that's dependent on the position of the valve. So mitral more than aortic, the rhythm, AF, sinus rhythm, LV function, patient age.
Yeah.
But as I said, the risk does fall after 19 days. The evidence is mixed. There have been a small number of randomized controlled trials comparing warfarin to aspirin, and they've shown no difference. But these randomized trials were limited by the relatively small number of patients. Whereas if you look at registry-based observational studies, which looked at thousands and thousands of patients, patients who took warfarin did have fewer strokes, despite the fact that they had an increased number of bleeds. I used to anticoagulate all my patients with a tissue prosthesis for 6 weeks, unless they were in AF, in which case they remained on the drug. But I've changed. So if a patient, as you asked, is a low-risk patient, he's having aortic valve replacement, he's in sinus rhythm, then our protocol where I work is that they receive aspirin 75 milligrams once a day indefinitely.
Yeah.
If a patient has a mitral valve repair or a mitral valve replacement with a tissue prosthesis, then I personally will anticoagulate them with a NOAC for 3 months of in sinus rhythm. If they're in AF or they've had an ablation to treat persistent AF, then they remain on the NOAC indefinitely. Now, I admit this is an evidence-free zone.
Yeah, I mean, there is some guidance in those two guidelines that you've published in the paper, and people can go away and read them in detail, but that's pretty close to what the guidelines say, to be honest, to my reading. Certainly, your practice seems very close to the American style of practice in terms of bioprosthetic valve anticoagulation. And what about after TAVI procedures? What is there any coalescence about what people should do after a TAVI?
Yeah, so the section of the paper, I have to thank Chris Malkin, who was a trainee in Sheffield, a very successful interventional cardiologist in Leeds, who contributed to the transcatheter portion of the paper. One of the big noticeable differences between antithrombotic management of patients with surgical devices and those with transcatheter devices is the amount and the standard, the grade of evidence available to inform guidelines, which are frankly superior. So the superior level evidence for patients with transcatheter devices. This in itself is interesting and possibly reflects the different approaches to practice of cardiologists and surgeons. But more importantly, I suspect it's the fact that surgical procedure and periprocedural management were devised at a time and an era when experience or even eminence were deemed to be more important than strong, robust evidence.
Yeah.
But when it comes to TAVI, what the evidence shows is very simple, that in the absence of an alternative evidence-based reason to be on either an anticoagulant or dual antiplatelet therapy, such as atrial fibrillation, acute coronary syndrome, or PCI, patients can be managed safely on the single antiplatelet agent, namely aspirin.
Perfect.
And that's what the evidence suggests.
That's what the guidelines show. And in terms of evidence gaps, Norman, are there any trials that or areas within the practice that you think could do with more trials? Any evidence gaps that you'd like to see plugged, even if they may not happen because of the reasons you outlined earlier?
Yeah, I think I'll go back to mechanical valves. I'm a big fan of mechanical valves. I'd like to see non-vitamin K or alternative vitamin K antagonists, you know, anticoagulants, which are easier to use. But as I mentioned, I doubt whether there'll be any further trials of factor 10 or thrombin inhibitors in this space. And unless somebody comes up with a totally new class of mechanical valve or a totally new class of anticoagulant, I don't think that's going to change. I think optimal antithrombotic management of patients who've had a surgical valve replacement, either tissue or mechanical, together with a coronary artery bypass graft, and a big percentage of patients who have valve surgery have a coronary artery bypass grafting at the same time. Very little evidence guides that. At the moment, what we do is if you need anticoagulation, you get anticoagulation and low-dose aspirin. And we know there's an increased risk of bleeding, but we don't know whether that's superior than just anticoagulant in terms of either ischemic events or thromboembolic events. I think in tissue prosthesis, again, the debate between anticoagulant and antiplatelet agents to prevent thromboembolic events. All the studies that have been published, both the randomized control studies and the large observational studies, have compared warfarin to aspirin. And we know there are so many numerous other actors in both the antiplatelet and the anticoagulant field. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. And finally, there's very little evidence to guide transcatheter mitral and tricuspid valve repair. and replacements. Although I'm sure, following my earlier point of cardiological evidence, the evidence undoubtedly will be available very soon.
Yeah, I think you're correct. I think most of the surgical trials were done, you know, two or three decades ago, right? When evidence gathering was in a sort of less advanced stage, and now it's very easy to gather real world evidence, you know, contemporaneously, I think, with electronic healthcare records and things to guide these decisions. But
yeah, absolutely.
It's been great to chat to you, and I'll make the paper free to anybody to read when the podcast comes out. There's some lovely figures in there and tables which summarize all of the evidence and the major trials in this area, and people can go away and read more about it if they so desire. But yeah, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you, James.